From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. Most of us believe we have pretty good character. A Wake Forest philosophy professor says we're probably wrong. You'll learn why. Hurricane Florence did hundreds of millions of dollars of damage to North Carolina roads. The state transportation secretary offers an assessment. As the debate over climate change continues, how can you separate fact from myth? A North Carolina scientist will help identify key facts. And three North Carolina congressional races are attracting significant attention. You'll learn which ones. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
In just days, we will know the direction North Carolina voters have chosen for the state through their votes for the North Carolina General Assembly. All 120 seats in the North Carolina House and all 50 seats in the North Carolina Senate are up for grabs. Our next guest closely follows the actions of state lawmakers, and she says that there is a lot at stake for every North Carolina household and business. Becky Gray, a frequent guest here at Carolina Journal Radio. She is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Becky, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
So is it fair to characterize it this way, that the vote next week will really be a verdict on the policies of the Republicans who've been in control of the legislature for a number of years now in terms of how they've approached fiscally conservative decisions about spending and taxation?
I certainly hope so, and I hope that's number one on voters' minds as they go. And as we then, in the next couple of weeks, we begin to analyze the results of what's going to happen this coming week. But Donna, I absolutely hope it is, and it certainly should be, a real valuation of what this General Assembly has done. We have the lowest unemployment rate in decades. Our economy is booming. North Carolina is a model for the rest of the country. We've had transformational tax reforms where 98% of North Carolinians are paying lower taxes. What I can't figure out is who are those other 2%
right,
with these transformational reforms that we've had. Healthcare is moving in the right, better direction. We know what will happen if the left gets back in charge, because they've told us. This General Assembly set aside $2 billion in savings for a rainy day, and boy, did we have a rainy day and needed that money. They were ridiculed. They were, Democrats during the debate on that said we ought not be putting that money aside. That's foolish. We ought not have savings of that magnitude. But boy, were we glad that we had it. Again, health care. You know, what we've seen, we saw this just in the last session. There were bills proposed that would offer more options in health insurance so that you could purchase a plan that best fits your family's need. On the other hand, we had a bill that was introduced by Democrats that would have implemented single-payer health care and insurance in North Carolina. When Roy Cooper proposed his budget this past year, he proposed rolling back the tax cuts. He proposed billions of dollars in additional taxes on North Carolina families. So this isn't something that we can just kind of say, well, maybe if things take a turn in the other direction, things may go this way. This is exactly where they're going to go, because they have told us this is what they're going to do. Increasing entitlement programs. You know, it's something that doesn't get a lot of attention, but because of this General Assembly in the last 8 years has really gotten Medicaid better managed and under control. What we had before was a runaway train that, since it was an entitlement program, it sucked up all of the energy and all of the decisions that were made in the budget. Because of really tough decisions in getting Medicaid better managed, we have more budget predictability now. There's more money to spend for teachers. There's more money to pay for education. There's more money to pay for roads. So when we talk about, you know, is this a turning point? You know, depending on how this election turns out on Tuesday, I would argue that, you know, it is clear which direction the state will be going in. We've seen what we've gotten under Republican leadership: lower taxes, fewer regulation, better managed government, better investments in education and infrastructure. We saw what we had under Democrats in 140 years, and they have told us what they're going to do if they take control.
Becky, what you're really talking about, I think, is a very different outlook on the role of state government.
Absolutely.
As it relates to a family, a single person, anyone who is living and working in North Carolina.
A business.
And that's kind of the choice that people have to make about, what do you want the relationship to be? How much do you want government involved in your life? A little, a lot? You have a clear choice.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we believe, and listeners who keep up with our work at the Lott Foundation, and if you don't, you certainly should, but, you know, we are huge proponents for personal responsibility and individuals having the right and the privilege to decide how they spend their money and what they do and how they prioritize needs for their families. If they choose to start a business, the way that they can do that. You know, the other direction that we have is much more government control over things. So it really is a real turning point in North Carolina.
For the past few years, we know that the conservatives and the Republicans have been in charge of both houses of the General Assembly. The Democrats had controlled things for a very long time prior to about 2010. But there is a very concerted effort by the Democrats to turn out their voters. They want power back in the state legislature. If they prevail, Becky, how would you see that this would affect the relationship between the legislature, which makes the laws, and the governor's office, because Roy Cooper is a Democrat? So would you expect a lot more things for them to be working together versus working at odds?
Well, Donna, that's a great question. What we've seen with this governor, Roy Cooper, is before he was even installed as the governor, he was filing lawsuits against the General Assembly. So this has been a governor for the 2 years that he has been in power, held the governor's office, has not been willing to work with the General Assembly at all. Now, if the Democrats take over one or both, the House and the Senate, or if they just lose the supermajority, and that is probably the more likely scenario that we're hearing from polls and things.
And just briefly explain the supermajority, what that means in terms of being able to override a veto,
well,
for
Republicans
example.
Hold the supermajority in both the House and the Senate, which means that as Governor Cooper vetoes bills, and by the way, he has vetoed more bills than any other governor. Would he veto bills? Yes, we know the answer to that as well. With the supermajority, they are able to override his veto, which requires a supermajority, a 3/5 vote in the General Assembly. So, you know, a little bit of an exercise in futility when the governor vetoes bills. The General Assembly has just been able to override that. If they lose that supermajority, then it becomes much more difficult to override his veto. The other thing, Donna, that I've noticed is in this just hyper partisan environment that we're in now. If you look back to when Beverly Perdue was the Democrat governor and Republicans controlled the General Assembly, did not have a supermajority in the House, there were enough moderate Democrats, common sense Democrats, I like to call them, who would evaluate the proposals and the issues that the Republican-led General Assembly was doing and often would vote with the Republicans on that. What we really see in this hyper-partisan environment that we have are fewer and fewer of those kind of middle-of-the-road folks, really on both sides of the aisle, to be honest with you. But what I would anticipate is if we get into a situation where one of the legislative bodies does not have the supermajority, it is going to be much more difficult to find those moderate, middle-of-the-road Democrats that would agree with Republicans on many of the initiatives that come up. So again, this is exactly what the Democrats are trying to do, is to erode that supermajority Republicans, on the other hand, are doing everything they can to hold on to it. So it's going to make these results on Tuesday. And, of course, we'll be analyzing that and talking about it afterwards, what it actually means as they move into a special session in November. And then, of course, the next long session that begins in January of 2019.
It's going to be a fascinating election for sure. And, of course, Becky, we'll have you back after the election to analyze exactly what voters decide on Tuesday. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. Where can folks follow you on Twitter?
I am at Becky Gray. It's B-E-C-K-I-G-R-A-Y.
Becky Gray, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E, .org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Most of us consider ourselves to be fundamentally good people. But is that true? How can we tell? What can we do to make ourselves better? Our next guest will help us start a conversation about those questions. Christian Miller is A.C. Reed Professor of Philosophy at Wake Forest University. He's also the author of the book, The Character Gap: How Good Are We? He recently shared themes from his work with the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So you really look at this issue from the aspect of character and the character that we have. And I assume that this is something that people don't spend a whole lot of time reflecting on, just what sort of character they have.
Well, maybe not in those terms, but I think it really matters in people's day-to-day lives. So the concept of character may be more an academic concept or a term that's more from the past. But I think when we think about examples of character and character traits, it's very real world. It's very much part of our lived experience. So when we think of honesty, for example, it matters to us whether our friends or our family or our leaders in society are honest or not. If they're dishonest, that could have terrible consequences. Or we think of other examples like justice or courage or bravery or heroism. These are examples of character traits, parts of people's character, if they have them, which I think we all want to have, we aspire to having. And if we don't have them, that can have, as I said again, really negative consequences. So character is very much a part of our way of thinking, even if we don't use the term character in our day-to-day lives.
Most of us probably look at ourselves and if we were asked, would say, yeah, I have a pretty good character. Your book and your research suggests that the reality might not match the perception.
That's correct. So when you survey people and you ask them to rate between 1 to 5, with 5 being a really high character, 1 being a low character, time and again, the average is about 4 out of 5. So people think that they're above average in their character. This is not just in the United States. This has been replicated across the world. Well, are they right about that? And am I right about my own beliefs? There are different ways to assess that and probe deeper. We could look at history. We could look at religious texts. My preferred approach, though, is to look at psychological research. What happens when you actually put people in real-world situations where they have an opportunity to cheat or not cheat, steal or not steal, lie or not lie, harm or not harm, even kill or not kill? There are studies that have been done for the last 50 years which probe people's character in these moral respects. And what do they find? Well, that's a long conversation we could get into some other time. But the upshot of what I interpret those studies saying is this. We have a mixed character. On the one hand, there is some good news. There are some positive aspects to our character, for example, when helping others and feeling empathy for their suffering. But on the other hand, there are some really disturbing sides to our character. For most people's character is such that we will not help. in a group emergency. That means when there's an emergency happening and other people aren't doing anything, we're very unlikely to do so as well. So that's an example of a good side of our character, but also an example of a bad side to our character. The overall picture, I think, is very much one of a mixed bag.
The example that's often mentioned is someone in a crowd cries for help and no one helps.
That's right. So that goes back to what psychologists call the group effect. So if you see someone in an emergency and you're by yourself, you're very likely to help that person. But if you're in a group where no one else is doing anything to help and the same emergency is happening, you're very likely not going to help yourself. This goes back to research in the 1960s called the bystander effect, where if you brought a participant into a room, they're part of a study, and they were told, fill out this survey. And then another random person comes in, told, fill out the survey. And the two of you are working out the survey. You don't know each other. And then the person who was in charge who gave you the surveys went into the next room. After a little time goes on, you hear a crash. Something's going on in there. Then this person starts screaming in pain. Ah, my leg, get this thing off me. It hurts terribly. What would you do? Well, naturally, I think you would say, I would do something to help. I would call out. I would go in the next room to check on the person. Well, it really matters what that other person is doing or not doing. It turns out that if that other person with you in the room doesn't help, it's extremely unlikely you're going to help. In fact, in that study, only 7%, not 70%, 7% of participants did anything to help the stranger in the next room. When another group was alone, when each person was alone, 70% helped. But in a group, only 7% helped.
That is the voice of Dr. Christian Miller. He's a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and also the author of the book, The Character Gap, How Good Are We? And I want to turn to that title. If your title is The Character Gap, that seems to suggest that there is some distance between the character we ought to have or think we have and the character we actually have.
That's right. So the title is framed exactly in those terms. There's, on the one hand, the character we actually have, and we've been spending some time talking about that. I call that a mixed character, some good, some bad. And then there's the character we ought to have. That's a virtuous character. A character where we have virtues like honesty, courage, temperance, justice, fortitude, gratitude, and the like. And so the idea of the gap is that there's a significant difference between the two in most people's lives. Not in everyone's life. We have examples of heroes and moral saints and the like. We can talk about Confucius. We can talk about Jesus. We can talk about Abraham Lincoln and the like, and examples like that. But those tend to be the outliers, the exceptions. For most of us, according to my interpretation of the psychological research, there's this gap between how we actually are and how we should be.
Are there ways to help shrink the gap, either overall or for us individually?
I hope so. I mean, it'd be rather pessimistic and kind of depressing news to find out there is this gap, and so what? You know, we're stuck with it. But the good news now is that there are strategies for overcoming the gap. They're not ones that are quick fixes, however. So there's no magic bullet or, you know, magic pill you can take or anything that's going to give you an overnight fix from going from mixed character to virtuous character. But let me give you a couple of ideas of something that over the long run can make a difference. One is looking to moral heroes and saints as role models. So have them be exemplars for us to follow. Look up to Abraham Lincoln with respect to his honesty. If I want to become a more honest person myself, I can use him as a basis for someone to emulate or admire. Another example has to do with learning more about just who we are in the first place. So getting the word out to people about how they tend to be in the ways they might not even recognize. So when you educate people about the impact of groups on helping, people, first of all, are surprised. I didn't realize this before. But secondly, they are more aware of it and in the future can combat it, can work against it. So the next time they're in a group, they might say, wait, I remember that this research I learned about. And it says, well, really, there's no good reason for me to not help this other person. Just because someone else isn't doing anything doesn't mean I shouldn't. I should really help. So then the third and final one I'll mention in our time together is this, moral reminders. So often we get sidetracked onto other things in our lives. We get caught up in our own self-interest. We get caught up in the latest sales on Black Friday. We get caught up in the new car we need to have. So our self-interest tends to sometimes push out moral considerations, push them to the side, what's right and what's wrong. moral reminders can be an important part of bringing back to our attention what's really important. So those could be things like wristbands. They could be notes that you leave to yourself or text messages. They could be a reading that you start your day with. And research has found that if you get your perspective back onto what's most morally salient, most morally important, that can help you steer a better course throughout your life, a more virtuous course. So those are three suggestions: moral exemplars and role models, moral reminders, and getting the word out and learning more about how our character actually works.
Well, it's a very interesting topic. If you'd like to learn more, you can read the book. It is titled The Character Gap: How Good Are We? Its author is Dr. Christian Miller, A.C. Reed Professor of Philosophy at Wake Forest University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Among Hurricane Florence's most significant impacts, damage to North Carolina's transportation system. State Transportation Secretary Jim Trogdon recently updated lawmakers.
Just the massive amounts of impact across our state was somewhat different. So all the way from Ocracoke Island, where we saw extensive damage, down to Wilmington, Brunswick County, all the way out to Charlotte in the west, all the way up to Ashe and Haywood and Watauga counties, we've seen damage in all of those locations. There was an estimated 8 trillion gallons of rain that fell. Florence would have filled Jordan Lake 536 times, a significant amount of rain. If you want to compare it to per population, if you look at our current population of 10.27 million, that would be like we just gave each North Carolinian 779,000 gallons of water.
How did Florence affect roads?
In total, we had 2,500 roads closed at any time. That was about 1,700 peak at one time. And then today we're down to a little less than 131. I believe it's 127 actually. And as you know, we had two major interstates closed in multiple locations.
Most of the roads have reopened, but there's still work left to do. The state DOT had identified about 3,100 sites that need some repair work.
Our focus moving forward is going to be on debris removal, both the woody debris, construction and demolition debris, and we're moving forward with that cleanup, and we'll be doing it as rapidly as possible. We are also focused on doing those long-term repairs at those 3,100 sites. Most of them will be done within the first 30 to 60 days, and then the remainder, the longer-term ones, will take slightly longer than that. Equally important, too, is how do we do things to mitigate future damage? We are very concerned with flooding of the interstate and closing of the interstates in future storms. There's just certain things we can't stop. I mean, huge rainstorms are going to create flooding, and flooding is going to close roads. But we believe there's some things that we can do in the longer term to make sure that in the future, I-95 and I-40 aren't as susceptible as they are today. As of today, our estimates on total cost of repair, it will be $266 million. We anticipate a 90% reimbursement on federal highway, 70% on FEMA. We anticipate that we will have at least a $66 million on state needs for Florence recovery.
And those numbers are bound to grow. That's Jim Trogdon, North Carolina's Secretary of Transportation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's hard to read, watch, or listen to the news regularly without hearing about the danger of global warming or climate change. But our next guest offers an alternative viewpoint on this topic. Dr. Bill Lynch is a fellow at the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and he's been looking into this issue for a long time. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you approach this basically by looking at the compound that's at the heart of this debate, carbon dioxide or CO2, and looking at the way that CO2 actually operates. Tell us a little
Absolutely.
Bit about that.
Well, CO2 is a perfect absorber for the infrared that the Earth has to release every time it's releasing energy. Gets sunlight comes in, and for every watt that comes in, a watt hour that comes in has to be released in that same 24-hour period for you to have a equilibrium. So CO2 is very vulnerable to this radiation coming off from the Earth, and so that's where a lot of the blanket comes from. So it's very important. But when you're all, when it's all said and done and you look at how much of the final blanket, which is the part of the energy that comes into the Earth, it's like a mini sun. The sun's there, now you get a blanket. Oops, it's hotter because you've got another mini sun here. But CO2 is only producing 25% of that. And yet all the plots say, oh, yeah, we move CO2 up. Look what happens. Well, CO2 is only paying 25% of the final contribution. In today's conditions, it's only 25%. So I knew that, and I started trying to look at whether CI2 really was more vulnerable. You used to hear that it sets up chain reactions. That's what they did in the 90s. There were chain reactions, and everything was going to happen. Whenever. What could they possibly be? Well, there are no chain reactions that are occurring. When CO2 warms the temperature, it will warm it by a little bit. If you add some CO2, you add a little bit of temperature. It doesn't do anything to the rest of the universe. It just raises the temperature. When it raises the temperature, all the other absorbers, let's say that 75%, take advantage of those extra photons that are coming off because of a little bit of extra temperature. They absorb more. They absorb more and the blanket goes up. So the blanket goes up by X amount, but 25% of it is due to CO2. And CO2, you could say, is a cause. But, you know, if the other elements, you added more of the other elements, you'd have the same effect. If you added more water, it would raise the temperature. And then you blame water for raising the whole thing. So it's a very simple molecule. It's very sensitive to absorption. It's like a piano string that you raise the tuning fork is the radiation that's coming off, and that piano string really likes it. So CO2 is very sensitive. It's very resonant with it. So it works. It's making the climate warmer, but it's not as drastic as some people would say.
And so those who say that higher levels of CO2 are guaranteeing all kinds of problems in our future are overstating what CO2 can do?
Absolutely. I mean, because nature does not allow that to happen. I mean, in effect, nature prevents calamities from happening. Look at it this way. The total amount of energy that mankind is creating through its own effort, through its own machinery, carbon, whatever, is 1/100% of the energy we get from the sun. And the sun is spending 10% of that energy just picking up a ruckus in the tropics, making all that water pour up into the crown above the tropics. So that goes up there. That's 10% of the sun's energy is doing that. And we're putting out, if we applied everything we had, we've got 0.01% of the sun's energy. So there's the sun, and then there's the energy and the rotation of the earth. There's a lot of other factors too. So CO2 contributes a small amount of temperature, but there's no way you could say it causes a runaway. If they say plus 2 degrees, plus 3 degrees, well, the temperature changes by plus or minus 10 to 15 degrees centigrade every day. Or, you know, and around the world, it changes plus or minus, I'm going to say 40 degrees centigrade. Nothing runs away. Nature, when it's disturbed, always comes back to an equilibrium. What the perfect example of is when you have a lightning strike. There's a problem up there that you've got 8,000 volts between here and then. The best way to resolve it is, so you have this lightning bolt and the problem is solved. You know, so that, I mean, it doesn't care about our stuff. Nature doesn't care about our stuff, but it solves its own problem.
We're speaking with Bill Lynch, and it sounds as if perhaps that the people who are making a big deal about CO2 and rising levels of CO2 are focusing a lot on these climate models and less on how the actual material, carbon dioxide, works. Is that a fair way to say it?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think the physicists are all, the climatologists, physicists are all doing their job. It's just that the papers that get selected and get chosen and get publicized are in that band that are on the outer fringe of possibility, probability, but not likelihood. And so I'll give you an example. Right now, the IPCC has reduced its claims. Let me back up a bit. In the 90s, they used to say that you raise the CO2 by 100 parts per million, the temperature go up by 1 degree centigrade. That's what really made me know that something was wrong, because by 150 parts per million, all the really sensitive parts of the of the spectrum have been sucked up by CO2 molecules already. Put more CO2, all you do is get that absorption closer to the Earth. It's going to absorb it all. You know, it just absorbs it all at those frequencies. So they said it was every 100 parts per million would raise it by 1 degree. I knew that didn't make any sense. And anyway, papers came out then that wasn't correct. And I actually made my own logarithm plot. In my little old logarithm plot, I used log 10 of CO2, and I figured it out. And it's like nowhere near linear. It doesn't want to keep going up. But other scientists figured that out, and I noticed that suddenly the IPCC changed their reports to be more correct. They had a log 2 model in there in which they said, well, if you raise CO2 and double it, the temperature is going to go up by, for I think earlier they said 2.5 to 5 or 4.5 degrees centigrade, and now they're saying 2 to 4. So they're pulling the number down. So 2 degrees centigrade is a lot lower than 4.5 degrees centigrade, I'll tell you that. But it looks like the real model that other people are getting, from what I understand besides me, is like 1 degree centigrade jump for every doubling. That's not a serious problem for, you know, in the next 100 years, you're likely to get another 1 degree centigrade.
In the brief time that we have left, some people are going to hear us and say, well, that's a lot of science, a little bit more than I understand. Mm-hmm. For you, what's the bottom line about what people should know about what CO2 does?
Well, CO2 does warm the planet. It's any extra energy you put into the planet every year. If the sun raised its output that was getting to the Earth by 0.01% a year, it would have an effect on our climate. That small amount of extra energy gift to us, if you did it every year, it would raise the temperature. So it is doing that. It does raise the temperature. But when they say it's going to have a runaway, that's the problem that the most, what I call it, fear cum belief, where you have a fear and it turns into a belief. You make it and now it becomes a gospel.
Well, it's an interesting topic, of course, one that's always in the news, climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it. We've been chatting with Bill Lynch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats, Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. All of North Carolina's 13 U.S. congressional seats are now on Tuesday's election ballot. Right now, Republicans hold 10 of those seats, Democrats 3 of the seats. But Democrats hope that they will pick up a seat or two here in North Carolina. All of that part of the National Democratic Party's effort to take control of the United States House of Representatives. Now, 3 North Carolina congressional races are particularly competitive, really interesting, and our friends at Carolina Journal have been reporting on these races. Carolina Journal's editor-in-chief Rick Henderson joins us now to take a look at these particular races. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
These 3 races, in terms of polling, are all pretty much too close to call?
Yeah, they're all within the margin of error right now. And what's been interesting about all 3 of them is that, depending on when the polling was done, the candidates, the leader has switched back and forth. You've seen some cases in which the Democrat has been toward the outer range of above the margin of error, and then the Republican would flip and take the lead in these races. And so these are very, very close. Also, the candidates seem to be playing largely from the same playbook, with one notable exception. And so it's interesting that this is being made, although these are federal offices to be sure, these are largely being made into national elections and not local elections so
now,
much.
Two of the three seats have a Republican incumbent right. in them with a Democratic challenger, and one has a Libertarian challenger as well. One of the seats is actually open.
Right.
Let's go ahead and talk about that seat first. That's District 9, where Republican Mark Harris is running against Democrat Dan McCready. That's an open seat because Mr. Harris defeated the incumbent, Robert
right.
Pittenger.
Right, and Robert Pittenger, well, defeated in the primary, was considered to be vulnerable also because he had some ethical issues and things like that, which he denied were problems, but still were sort of a lingering cloud over him. And Mark Harris has run for office before statewide. He ran in the Senate race and against Tom Tillis in the Republican primary. Did very well, didn't prevail, but has a lot of name recognition. And is actually doing a lot better than people would have expected in that particular district, because Dan McCready is running as sort of a centrist Democrat, pro-business Democrat. There is a Republicans for McCready organization that's active in that district, which is in the Charlotte area roughly. But Mark Harris has done really well, and he, in most recent polling, he's been in the lead in some of those polls. And so he's doing well. I think his name recognition is helpful, the fact that he's a well-known pastor. We saw this sort of thing with the 6th District a couple of terms back with Mark Walker, who had yard signs everywhere, even though he was not considered to be a strong candidate necessarily. He not only won surprisingly won the primary, but the general election. You may see the same sort of thing with Reverend Harris.
Interesting that the National Democrats really think they've got a premier candidate
right.
in Dan McCready. They think he might be a model for flipping some seats.
Yes, that's right. And so this is the race that I think they're counting on. They're banking on taking this one. And the fact that the Mark Harris is doing so well must have the Democrats flummoxed to some extent.
Let's move on then to the District 2 competition. This is one that is Wake County and a little bit east. It's got part of Johnston County, Nash County, Franklin, and Harnett County. The Republican incumbent is George Holding. The Democratic challenger is Linda Coleman, and a Libertarian in this race as well, Jeff Matamu, I believe his name is. Tell us about the dynamics there.
Interesting race in because in so much as George Holding is your classic workhorse, not show horse, and Linda Coleman doesn't have a very dynamic personality either. And so you have two candidates who are not going to exactly deliver stem winding speeches on the campaign trail. But George Holding took this seat in the 2016 election, after the redistricting took place. He formerly served in the 13th congressional district and is now moved over to the 2nd, knocked out Renee Elmers, took the seat, and is running very much on a traditional Republican stances on issues of taxes and regulations. He's very strong on immigration enforcement, and so there he stands with President Trump. He's criticized President Trump for both his demeanor in the White House and also for his stand on trade. And so that's one place where he's sort of separated himself from the president. Linda Coleman is running a very standard Democratic race in which she says health care is the most important issue, health care, health care, health care. When asked in a recent debate what she would do about the deficit or the national debt, she said we got to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. And Representative Holding said we got to look at entitlements, which is a little bit of a third rail kind of dangerous issue to talk about. But he's one of the few Republicans who's actually talking about it. What's also of interest in that race is that neither one of them has said who they would support for Speaker of the House in the race that Representative Holding said, well, there are about a half a dozen good candidates out there, and Coleman would not say whether she would vote for Nancy Pelosi or not.
Interesting in that race, you've got George Holding talking about entitlements. Of course, President Trump has said he doesn't want to touch
right.
entitlements, so that's a separation there between those two. Linda Coleman, well-known in North Carolina. She has run for statewide office before,
right.
and she's held different positions. So she has a grassroots movement out
yeah.
there for her?
Well, she does, and also because she was woefully underfunded. Holding's campaign has a lot more money than hers. However, Linda Coleman is getting some outside money, and we're seeing campaign ads run run from outside groups supporting her, and then some that she's funding herself. But it is a situation in which you've got one candidate who's an incumbent who is much more in better financial shape to run.
What about the Libertarian in that race? Is he going to be a factor?
Pretty much a non-factor. He was invited to participate in the Spectrum News debate, declined to do so, which is very unusual because typically Libertarians beg to be involved in these events, and he chose not to. So I don't see him as a factor in this race.
Interesting. So that's the District 2 situation. Moving on to District 13, that is Republican incumbent Ted Budd. His Democratic challenger is Kathy Manning.
Now, that's an interesting race as well because it's gotten very personal. Kathy Manning is part of a wealthy business family, if you will. She and her husband both have been involved in a lot of business interests. She's a local philanthropist. And Ted Budd operates a gun range and a gun store. Ted Budd's a freshman, so this, generally speaking, would be the easiest opportunity for people to knock him off, if that's the way that the general election rhetoric goes, is that the freshman winning his or her first term is the most difficult reelection prospect. And it's a very close race. Kathy Manning, again, has lots and lots of money. Ted Budd doesn't have as much. But Budd's been pretty much running even to her or ahead of her. And the two of them have gotten kind of nasty about things. There were some issues dealing with a publicly funded garage in Greensboro, which there were some debate about whether or not Manning and her husband had a financial stake in this tax-funded garage. And so it's been, again, an issue that's gone back and forth about is one getting advantage of some sort of cronyism or not.
And District 13, the general area for that district?
That's the Triad and kind of the rural part of the Triad. Also, it does include Greensboro, of course, but it is a bit more of the Chatham County. I mean, that general sort of area, which is not as urbanized as some of the other districts. And Ted Budd, again, kind of came out of nowhere to win the primary. And so he again, has scored better than some people thought in the polling in these races.
Well, these are the three that we're going to be watching the most intently on election night. We're talking about District 9, District 2, and District 13, three of North Carolina's 13 U.S. congressional seats. Of course, all 13 are on the ballot. Carolina Journal reporting on all of these. A lot of post-election analysis to come as well from our guest, Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief. Well, that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.